In those days, Caesar Augustus issued a decree that census should be taken of the entire Roman world. This was the first census that took place while Quirinius was governor of Syria. And everyone went to their own town to register. So Joseph also went up from the town of Nazareth to Galilee, to Judea, to Bethlehem, to the town of David, because he belonged in the house of a line of David. He went there to register with Mary, who was pledged to be married to him and was expecting a child. While they were there, the time came for the baby to be born, and she gave birth to her firstborn, a son. She wrapped him in clothes and placed him in a manger because there was no guest room available for them.
Hey, so today's going to be a little different as we get started with Advent. Full disclosure here. I'm excited today, and I've prepared. Preaching, though, is a difficult thing because you also have to bring, you know, to some degree, you bring your emotions into it. I don't think that I have prepared my, emotionally, I'm just not at a place where I feel very trustworthy of where I am today. So I just want to kind of give you a few things to think through as we enter into the Advent season. So today, if today's a little bit different, I just feel like the best thing that the Lord would have us do today is just to consider what this season means and to consider also what that might mean for us. So if I seem a little more withdrawn, it's more to be out of reverence for God's word and what I believe, you know, this text is introducing to us. So with that qualifier, we'll begin. So every family has Christmas traditions. We have a lot of them. We watch a lot of the same movies. We go to Opryland to see the same lights we've seen for 38 straight years. At least I have seen them for 38 straight years. They haven't changed yet. Except they took down the lion that was playing the harp in the middle of the area where you're exhausted and want to die. So outside of that, it's the same thing. We do the same traditions. We'll go see ice, which is what it sounds like. It's a lot of ice, and this is the shape of Charlie Brown this year. But we do it every year because it's our traditions. We have Christmas Eve traditions. We have Christmas Day traditions, and that is probably the temptation of this season, is to over-tradition this season and miss the invitation of this season. Because if this season is true, then God is really with us in ordinary glory. This means that God really is with us when you're at Costco, and that God really is with us when you're in traffic, which is in Hendersonville, which can take a half hour to get from one stoplight to the other, that God somehow is really with us, that God is with us as we are navigating times of incredible inflation, where some of you are probably wrestling with the reality that you may not be able to purchase your first home as early as you'd like to, that He is with us. That God really is with us in the ordinary glory of dealing with the complexities of kids who are grown now and they're out living their own lives, that He's actually with us. He's with us when you're dealing with your debilitating back pain, and He's with us as you're navigating the complexities of a family that can just go on and on and on, that He's with us. Henry Nouwen says, "The Lord is coming always, always coming. When you have ears to hear and eyes to see, you will recognize Him at any moment of your life, that life is an advent. Life is recognizing the coming of the Lord." So I want to show you first that there is always a larger story unfolding. The text shows us this pretty quickly. I don't know if you've noticed that my Bible being open in front of you, some of you may be on the digital Bible, but the Bible here, you can see that we are at the birth of Jesus, the start of His story, yet we're over two-thirds into the book because we are learning that there is a meta-story unfolding. And meta-story is the idea that there is a much larger plot taking place, and in the Christian worldview, a larger story is always unfolding. You are not in the story of the United States of America. You are not in the story of the state of Tennessee. You are not in the story of 2025. You are in a much larger story, and the plot line goes something like this. Genesis 1 through 3, everything's going hunky-dory for a little while. Genesis 3, things go pretty poorly. And then you have the whole Old Testament, and we in Luke 2 are at the climactic moment where Jesus is born. And the climax of all the scripture is that Jesus is born and that Jesus is resurrected and just Jesus in general. And then all of the New Testament is the descending conflict of what all of this means now as we get closer and closer to a resolution, which is redemption. So that's the story you're in right now, and that's the story the Bible is continually moving towards. And every event on every day is in some way contributing to that end. How cool is that? So secondly, we see in this that if there is a larger story, Joseph and Mary aren't even main characters. which is pretty tough because they had a pretty heavy load to carry, if you ask me, having to deal with the complexities of saying, yeah, I'm a virgin, but I'm having a baby, and it happens to be the Son of God. Pretty, you know, that's a lot to ask of somebody. I think that's okay to say. And Joseph having to, you know, wrestle with that for a few moments and deal with the heavy burden of, hey, you're raising the Son of God. No pressure. Please don't blow it, though. And then this is the life that they live, but they're not even the main characters. But what we see throughout here is not one time do they have main character syndrome. They don't think that they're the center of the story. They just very humbly go from city to city doing what's been asked of them. Mark Sayers is a brilliant thinker from Australia. He's a preacher, but he's a preacher and a thinker. Those aren't always the same thing, unfortunately. But he's a preacher and a great thinker. I shouldn't have said that, but it's out there now. And he talks about that we live in the age of the platform self, where we have an intensified sense of individual importance. So everyone's always wondering, how is this going to either impact me, or how am I going to have to hold together the future? So two questions that main character syndrome starts to show itself out in. First is you're always wondering, how does this impact me and my desires? So we saw this in 2020. I'm not sure if you're familiar. Something went down in 2020 that was kind of, you know, a big deal. And everyone just immediately was like, well, how is this going to impact me? Pay no mind to the global pandemic, because now when I get my groceries, it's going to take a little longer. And so we immediately were looking at the self. This is a result of the platform self. How does this impact me and my desires? We see this when someone goes to a restaurant to unwind on a Friday and their food doesn't come out just precisely perfect. And now they're upset at the whole restaurant because this whole restaurant existed for one reason tonight, and that was to help you unwind, and they just blew it because all of these people were born today for such a time as this for you to get your hamburger exactly as you would like it on a Friday. This is the platform self. And secondly, the platform self does it in this more subtle way. What do I need to do to ensure that my whole life doesn't end up a tragedy? AKA, I'm the main character, and if I blow it, everything falls apart, right? Mark Sayers says this is the platform mentality, main character syndrome. So this is where I want to ask you this question. Do you ever wonder how God might be at work in you and around you? If not, it may be that you're missing the larger story, or you got main character syndrome. But here's what I love about this story. I think everyone in here feels the pressure to be great, to do something great, to have great memories, to accomplish great things. But the Christmas story is the most ordinary story that's ever been told. Let's stop romanticizing it for a second and just look at what the text is teaching us about Christmas. Joseph and Mary are in Nazareth. Here's a map. They're sent to Bethlehem. Kind of a long journey. On here, it looks like it's just a few feet, but it's a little longer in reality. And then they have to leave Bethlehem and flee to Egypt. We're going to learn about this next week. That looks like a long journey, a couple more feet. And then at some point, they have to head back to Nazareth. So this is just an ordinary place. Just normal. It's on a map. I'm sure it kind of, you know, I'm sure their traffic's bad and stuff like that too. I'm sure they get a lot of similarities. I'm sure, I don't know if you've ever been around a pregnant woman, probably didn't enjoy the journey the entire time. No shade on pregnant ladies. I felt that way on Friday all day after eating a lot. I didn't want to get up and go anywhere. So, like, I'm sure it was a difficult thing. But it's a pretty ordinary life they were living. They lived under the reign of Rome, and Caesar Augustus was the emperor at the time. Caesar Augustus sounds like a pretty cool name, but his real name is just Gaius Octavius. Pretty cool second name, not necessarily the first name. Just a normal guy. He's the grandnephew of Julius Caesar. You probably heard about him occasionally. E tu, Brute, ring a bell. And there was a census that was going out for everyone to go back to the city they were born in so they could get a count on population. And why did they want to count on the population? To make sure they were taxing people enough, because nothing has changed in 2025 years. So what I'm saying to you, Joseph and Mary lived under a person who was afraid of losing power and would do anything to keep it, trying to figure out how to tax people the most to fund the government and the expansion of it. Because nothing's changed in the entire time. We now know that God was behind it because ordinary circumstances are ridden with the divine. Now, we don't think about ordinary circumstances being written with the divine anymore, that God is actually at work in the story. One thinker, Max Weber, has this philosophy that we are part of the Enlightenment rationalism, which means that everything has a logical answer, which has led to the disenchantment of the world, which has led to this really terrible case of a German word, and I'm going to butcher this, but I'm going to give it a go for all of the high school graduates out there. Entzauberung der Welt, that is not even close, but it's this case of an illness that is running through our culture right now, which just means we are the disenchanted world. There is nothing beyond us. Everything makes sense. Everything has an explanation, and everything is just an inconvenience, random circumstance, or an explanation that you can see. For a visual of this, anyone in here seen the Santa Claus? I mean, come on. I literally, you should cancel everything that you have to do today if you've not seen Santa Claus, and you should go watch it. There's a stepdad in there named Neil. Neil has on a nerdy sweater, and he is the worst part of the movie because he's always like, well, you know, don't believe in anything, Charlie, and this is a good, right thing to do, is to never believe in anything, and everything has a logical explanation. And in 2025, we've all become a bunch of nerds named Neil, wearing our sophisticated sweaters who have an answer for everything. Everything has a logical explanation. Everything has a rational reason, scientific theory. Everything can be proven, and it is high time at the Advent season to re-enchant the world again. We see everything in black and white. Oh, I have to go to Bethlehem because this daggum governor is telling me I've got to go because of taxes, and the entire time, there was a much larger story that's far more than black and white, that was God with us. Now, this is why I think you love Christmas, because for 1 month of the year, you don't have to be your snobby, sophisticated self with all of your answers and all of your explanations. And just for a day sometimes, if not a week sometimes, you can believe beyond a shadow of a doubt that there is something beyond this life, and you're not seen as a fool because of it, and you're not seen as silly because of it. But for a moment, you're able to look beyond this life and see something more. This is this idea that God is with us. And how do we even begin to believe and re-enchant the world this way? It's through this really cool word that I'm sure you use every day in your sentences: sovereignty. God's sovereignty. Because Caesar Augustus is ordering the census, but God is the one who's ordaining the census. Mary and Joseph are walking the walk, but God is getting them there. The whole story of redemption is hanging on two teenagers' ability to get to Bethlehem and have a baby. And God has not left it to chance. He was sovereign in it all. The first time I learned about the sovereignty of God, it scared the mess out of me. And here's how I came to understand it. So God is omniscient, which means he knows everything. God is omnipresent, which means he is everywhere. God is omnipotent, which means he's more powerful than all things. So he's in control. John Piper says it this way: God is powerful and authoritative to the extent of being able to override all powers and authorities. He's him, as the kids would say it nowadays. My generation would say he's the Alpha, but he is him, is the way that maybe John Piper would say it now. Probably not. But it's the idea that God's in control. So does this mean then, if God is the one who is moving Gaius Octavius to do this, that God is in control of this emperor? Well, we see in Romans 9, he hardened Pharaoh's heart. But there's two reasonable questions that I think that you should be wondering if you're actually listening. The first one is does this mean that God causes bad things to happen? Because next week we're going to learn about Herod and the slaughtering of the innocents. That doesn't make it into many kids' plays, understandably so. It would be a really awkward transition from the angels. And I don't know that anyone in here would want your kid playing it, right? Like, hey, I'm the soldier who's doing the kid thing, right? So it's not in there. It was okay, y'all could laugh, that was pretty funny. But it's like, does he allow this? The two words that we'll use in theology to explain God's sovereignty is his efficacious will, which means he is making this happen, and his permissive will, which means he's allowing this to happen. a great place to look at this. And then creation, he spoke and light came. He's making light happen. He's speaking and the animals are coming. And then when Adam and Eve sin, he allows them to. Now, where I've wrestled with the idea of God's sovereignty before it re-enchants our world is I've had to come to understand God's sovereignty this way. It's when you use it as an explanation versus it just needs to be in your perspective. So if I trip over a cord, which I do once a week or so, not over cords, just over my own feet, and I almost fall on the ground, or let's assume I fall on the ground, if someone says, what made you fall? If I tripped over a cord and I say, it was gravity. Gravity made me fall. Not my clumsy self, my dumb feet. It's not my dumb huge feet. It's not them. It was gravity is why I fell down. Well, you're only telling part of the story, and gravity was a big player in this story, but it wasn't just your big dumb feet. It was part gravity, and it was part your big dumb feet, and it was part of the cord that wasn't taped down. It was all of that together. So when we talk about God's sovereignty, it's like talking about gravity. It's going to be part of all of it, but to attribute every moment of every day to God just did it, and God just did it, and God just did it, you're really limiting what the Bible allows to be a really complex thing to say all of these things are at work, and you should have all of these things at work in your understanding of the world. So when we look at this text, God's sovereignty is at work in it, and Caesar is also the one commissioning the census. God is the one ensuring that Jesus is born in Bethlehem, and Joseph and Mary are the ones who are walking there. All of it's working together. Secondly, why doesn't he stop bad things then? There really is no good answer to this. There are fantastic theological answers, but the reason I say there's no good answer to this is the reason we ask that question is because it's a heart question, not a head question. No one's ever said, why does God allow bad things? And someone says it's because we live in a broken world. And they say, you know what? You're right. I don't miss my loved one anymore. Thanks for the explanation. Ah, you're right. How did I not think of that? Gosh, Genesis 3, daggummit, I feel a lot better now. So next week, we're going to look at how he steps into that. What I would tell you is, if you're going through a dark time, don't allow the cheer of the Toyota-thon commercial to fool you. This is your season. Fleming Rutledge says, the disappointment, brokenness, suffering, and pain that characterize life in the present world is held in the dynamic tension with the promise of the future glory that is yet to come. In the Advent tension, the church lives its life. Let me put better words around that. Because of Advent, you can be honest of how much you miss your loved one. Because of Advent, you can be honest at how hard it is to work 50, 60 hours a week and it not be enough to start a home. Because of Advent, you can be honest with how much you miss your kids. Because of Advent, we have a reason to know why the world is dark, and yet a marvelous hope at how to look past it. So his sovereignty. And there's a lot of controversy over how much free will does man have. And if you want to spend the rest of your life explaining that, good luck. I'm good. But here's what I would say it means. The sovereignty of God at least means nothing happens outside of God's intended story. At least that. This is something about what Romans 8:28 means, that all things work together for the good of those who are called according to his purpose, or if you want to say it this way, according to his story. So how does God's sovereignty re-enchant the world around us? Well, God is sovereign, and he's in control of this text. Three considerations from this text in God's sovereignty. First, God's sovereignty means that even when things fall apart, they're ultimately falling into place. Joseph's plans are shot. He was going to marry this woman. They were going to live in Nazareth. And now she has a baby. I'm sure his family handled that really rational because family does that. Oh, she's pregnant and it was God's, you know, the Son of God. It makes total sense. I'm in on that. So now here he is traveling to another city, probably more questions than answers, and yet here he is in the middle of a God story. Secondly, God's sovereignty means that when nothing appears to be happening at all, it all may be happening. Could you imagine just walking to Bethlehem? Mary's like, hey, do you think that you got a room yet? No, we'll get one when we get there. There's always open rooms in Bethlehem. He gets there, knocks on the door. There's no rooms. You know that glare that Mary probably, oh, there's always going to be a room. Because, you know, Joseph and Mary, contrary to what some people think, were not divine. They were people, and you know that that didn't go over well. Yeah, sorry. So, Mary, we're just going to have to stay. We have found a really great spot, a lot of wildlife, a view, and it's a stable. But just go with me for a second. There's not a bed, but there's a trough where the animals eat out of. And, you know, this is all, you know, like when they were in it, like we sing songs about it, and it's beautiful. Hark the herald angels sing, glory to the new world. Yeah, glory. Yeah. And then they're living in the mess of it. And yet the whole thing was coming together. And then finally, God's sovereignty in all things means his involvement in all days. This means you've never went to just a grocery store and it didn't matter. This means that every moment is chock full of redemptive story potential. This means that that annoying little conversation that your kid wants to keep having with you may be chock full of God potential. This means that every coffee, every drive somewhere, every drive from somewhere, every mourning moment, every celebratory moment, every dollar invested in the bank account, and everyone that's going out of it, this season is begging you to see that things are not as they seem. They're bigger than you think they are. They're brighter than you think they are. And they may be harder than you could have ever dreamed they would be. And they may never make sense on this end of life, but it'll be like the end of all of the Avengers movies. It all seems to work out the way it was supposed to work out. That's what the idea of God's sovereignty means, is that he is involved and that there has never been a day that he has not been involved in. So the spouse that you're complaining that he gave you, that you asked him for all those years, that all of it, he's there, he's involved. That this moment on this day, that God is present in writing a story. And how incredible is it? Because all the stories that people are writing today, pardon me, they stink. And I was going to say a different word, but I pivoted at the last second because my parents are in the room, because otherwise I would have said they all suck because they're not as good as this story. Is this it? Is this what the world has to offer? This is the dream? This is the story that's actually worth reading, that all of this, all of the loss, all of the pain, all of the sacrifice is leading to a redemptive end where you look at God and say, look at you writing this story. What a crazy story. Do you think that Joseph and Mary ever thought they're going to sing songs about this day and they're going to celebrate about this day and for some reason they're going to put trees inside their house about this day? But one day, this is going to be way bigger than anyone could have imagined. And yet, because God is involved, that's what it meant. That's what it meant for them. And listen, you're not Mary and you're not Joseph. Praise the Lord that we're not. Amen. I am so thankful that I've got three wonderful kids, but not one of them is redemptive history hinging on right now. All right? I just wanted to marry a good guy, not save the world. All right? So, or maybe never get married and just live with us forever. Those are my two options. But some point, at some way, for some reason, at some moment, Advent is saying, get your eyes off the dirt. Keep 10 toes down, 2 eyes up, and believe that something is happening bigger, brighter, and more holy than you could imagine. Because if this is the story of God, God is still writing that story here and now. But church, have we lost our holy imagination? Can I warn you that it was those who had life figured out that missed the birth of Jesus? Everyone who understood the Old Testament, I know what that means. They were the ones who missed the birth of Christ. I know what he would look like if he came. I've got all the answers. But can you live with an holy imagination, the awareness that it's in this season that those who are willing to live with questions were the ones who arrived at the answers. But those who arrived with the answers were the ones that Jesus questioned. Advent's begging us to look beyond this life to the next. Advent's begging us to stop being frustrated just with your work and to ask yourself, what might God be doing in this remarkably frustrating work? So if God's writing that story, just three closing thoughts. First, God's sovereignty means that some of life has no reasonable explanation, but may have a divine one. So in this text, Caesar commissions the census. But Jesus had to be born in Bethlehem. In Micah 5:2, it says, "But you, O Bethlehem, who are too little to be among the clans of Judah, from you shall come forth for me one who is to be the ruler in Israel, whose coming forth is from old, from ancient of days." This is a prophecy about Jesus. And for them to believe that Jesus was the Messiah, he had to be born in Bethlehem. I mean, think about this for a second. If Joseph says, let's just do this thing right here in Nazareth, redemptive history hung on that. For the Jews to believe that he was the Messiah, some of which still don't believe, they had to see that he was sent. And there's no good logical explanation for this when you're the one walking to Bethlehem. But there is a redemptive one. Tim Keller sums it up very brilliantly when he says everything in the Hebrew worldview militated against the idea that a human could be God. Jews would not even pronounce the name Yahweh nor spell it. And yet Jesus Christ, by his life, by his claims, and by his resurrection, convinced his closest Jewish followers that he was not a prophet telling them how to find God, but God himself coming to find us. This little inconvenient detail was redemptively so important. And guys, I want to make this so clear. I am not saying that you are Mary and Joseph. I'm saying that if this is how God writes stories, if this is how God involves himself in the world, maybe the person who canceled at 11 to make room for what happened at 11:30 wasn't just a coincidence. Maybe the kids that are living in your home wasn't just random and chance. That's why I would say, what might God be doing? Not what definitely is he doing. What kind of fool would say that? Could you imagine Mary and Joseph saying, I think God just wants to bless us with a nicer house. That's why we're going to Bethlehem. I'm sure of it. Well, we're in a stable. God's wanting us to learn about livestock. He's going to open up a livestock business through our lineage one day. That's probably what this is. I apologize for the sarcasm. My family is probably sick of it. But this is, like, what might he be doing? So what I would ask you is, what might God be doing in the random things of your life? Secondly, God's sovereignty means that the timing may always fill off, but he's never a second early or a second late. It says in verse 1, in those days, what days? The perfect days for Jesus to be born. They had just passed in 27 BC and 180 AD an act called the Pax Romana, which means the peace of Rome. So for the first time, Rome had peace over the earth. Now, they used it. They got to peace through some bloodshed. And it was different story, different day, next week, actually. And there was this time of peace where, think about this for a second. So for the first time, they were unified under the Greek language. There was religious protection given to all. And then roadways began connecting cities as they began expanding their reach. Pretty perfect time for an itinerant preacher who just walked around and taught people. So, hey, Jesus' ministry is going to be walking back and forth teaching people. Wouldn't it be great if he was born right when those roadways were there and the language was there? And this is just one of a million reasons why it was the perfect time. And yet it's okay to be those people who were living in the middle time of saying, how long, oh Lord, how long, oh Lord, how long, oh Lord, who got into heaven and said, dadgummit, we were wrong the whole time. You came at the right time. We should have trusted you the entire time. Because we've had those moments, right? And then what do we do the very next moment? Where are you, God? I need you right now. I mean, how many times
Have you thanked God that you did not marry the first love of your life? You're like, thank the Lord that he preserved me from my wickedness. And then you're like, yeah, God. And then you get right back in another one. You're like, gosh, he's so late right now. Where is he, God? And God's sovereignty means that the time is always right. So church, what might be falling into place in ways that you cannot see? And then finally, God's sovereignty means you just have to be faithful. Joseph and Mary were not asked to be perfect. Heck, they weren't even asked to be in control of the situation. Some of y'all can breathe for a second. What? To be a good Christian person, you don't have to be in control of the future? I didn't know that. Because see, I thought this whole thing was based on my works, my prayers, my devotion. It's crazy because I know I was saved by grace, but I know that's kind of like a catch. And like, you know, you're saved by grace, but outside of that, everything hinges on you, right? So your kids are going to end up hellions if you step off to the left or right. And then you're going to be broke if you don't tie 10% down to the 0.00, like down to cumin, is the way they would say in the New Testament. And then ultimately that's going to fall apart, and that you're going to be sick if you have unforgiveness in your life, and you're going to probably die early if you don't drink enough green things all along the way. But that ultimately, are you telling me that Mary and Joseph were just asked to be this crazy thing? It's faithful. See, here's what's so crazy about Joseph. He was perfect to be this father of Jesus for two reasons. One is he's from the lineage of David. We see in the text that he's from the lineage of David. And that his hometown was Bethlehem. So the two things that made him perfect, he had nothing to do with. How cool is that? They didn't look down and say, Joseph is a brilliant thinker. He should be the father of the Son of God because he will be a philosophy major and he will help instruct this little guy into being the Son of God. No, it had to do with something that he had nothing to do with. That doesn't play good when you're wanting to beat your chest at how great you are, but it plays really good when you're being honest with how ordinary you are. And that should help you. What we learn about David, David didn't get a lot of love in this season. We asked Mary if she knew, but did Joseph know? Did Joseph get it? Church, I hope this helps you feel far more important than you could have ever imagined, and also helps you breathe in a way you never thought possible. If you realized how important your life is in the story of God, you would suffocate. And if you realize how sovereign God is, you would be able to breathe easy again. No one can be the parent to your children. You are absolutely essential to God's plan in their life. And yet it will not be by your might that God works in their life. So for the dads who are punting on being godly fathers, where are they supposed to get that from if it's not you? And for the moms who take on the pressure, what would God say to Mary? You think Mary's over here wondering and worried every moment of every day? Dadgummit, we gave him too much screen time. Will he be the Son of God tomorrow? He's not eating organic right now. Those are just jokes. They're in our family. They're not at anyone else in here. So just us. I didn't get Jesus in the best school. Will he be the Son of God? The better question is, when it's time to go to Bethlehem, do you go? When it's time to steward and offer your womb, will you give it? To get in the Jesus story, you just need availability, not ability. Man, if I was more charismatic, I'd really get after that right now. But I feel like that we just got to stay focused. So what's your role? I want everybody right here. Let's go eyes. Your role in the Jesus story is faithfulness. Not control. Not even perfection. What does faithfulness look like if we were to ask Mary and Joseph? If you could have coffee with Mary and Joseph, some of Bethlehem's finest, brewed right to perfection, the Bethlehem brew, straight from right out the ground. I think this is what Joseph would say to you. Is daily, ordinary, biblical obedience and the occasional supernatural interruption response. Joseph just woke up every day and was a good, godly man. And then one night an angel woke him up and said, hey, this is of God. Name him Jesus. Yes, sir, I'm on it. That's what faithfulness is. So faithfulness is reading the scriptures to your kids and praying for them. And the occasional supernatural nudge. Faithfulness is showing up, giving a hard 8 to 10 hour work day with the occasional supernatural nudge. Hey, reach out to this person. How does a lost person come to the Lord if it's not for the faithfulness of God's people? Just daily good witnessing and the occasional supernatural nudge. What might God do through your life if you were faithfully submitted to him? So for us today, this means inconveniences are never irrelevant. They had to take a 90-mile trip pregnant to Bethlehem. Anybody in on that? Anybody like, yes, Lord. We went to SeaWorld. Andrea still talks about it to this day. 9 months pregnant. She talks about like she served terms. It was such a hard day on her. We probably walked 6 miles that day, and she's tough. She's tough, so tough. Let me make that very clear. 90 miles. This is so inconvenient. Gosh, Caesar Augustus, what a jerk. Got to travel. Now, maybe they had a better attitude than me. I'm completely reading myself in the scripture because I'm going to tell you exactly what would have happened if your boy would have been in Nazareth. I got to go home. These dudes are taxing me at all times, man. They're always taxing people. And now here I am. I've got to go to, I've got this wife who is immaculately conceived a child. And now I've got to go back to Bethlehem. I got to see these dudes I don't even want to see. That's why I moved to Nazareth in the get-go. And there's not even a nice place for me? Are you serious? And yet God's hands were all over it. Where might God be in the chaos or in the ordinary? Secondly, your feelings can't become your perspectives, and your perspective does not invalidate your feelings. Just because you feel like everything's falling apart doesn't mean that God isn't writing the story. And what I know the whole time is you're becoming like Jesus. I know a few people in here who are suffering hard. So hard. And I don't know why they're having to walk from here to there. I don't know. But I know that with every step, they're becoming like Jesus, even if they don't see it. Because I can't promise you how your story ends. But with all of the authority of the minister of the gospel, a life fully submitted to being faithful to Christ always makes you like Jesus in ways that you could never have imagined. Church, in the Advent season, I'm here to remind you that God is hidden among us. Truly hidden among us. Man, I love the description that Ziva read at the end of that text. You'll find him laying in a manger. Who? A baby. Where? In a manger. What? Wrapped in swaddling clothes. Is there anything more approachable than a baby? Some of y'all extreme moms know how approachable babies are. Don't touch my baby. Why? Because even strangers feel compelled and allowed to touch a baby. So of all the ways that God could enter into the story, he makes himself the most approachable, the most knowable. They swaddled babies in the first century because it's what allowed their limbs to grow straight. So Jesus is having to have the same cloths to make his limbs grow straight as you and I would, which means that he knows what it feels like to have tightness in his muscles. He knows what it feels like to get to the end of a long work day. He knows what it feels like, and yet he's hidden, but he's not hidden to where you can't find him, and he's not hidden for a type of people. He's hidden for a type of person, someone who's humble enough to get their eyes off of the black and white for a second, who feel like they've got all of life figured out. He's got time for those who aren't schemers, who are always planning and charting the next day and the next course and controlling the universe through their work ethic and their planning and trying to figure out how to protect their own throne. That he is the God who is in the lowly manger, and we can't stomach it. We make our Christmas services bright with sparkles, and we have moving lights, and we have the spectacle because we can't stomach that when God wanted to present himself, he presented himself in the most ordinary of places. And I think this is to our downfall, and that's why when we want to be close to God, we go to worship nights, and we got to go hear this person preach, and we've got to go and get ourselves all dressed up, but he's actually in the Costco line, and he's actually in the middle of the chaotic life that you're living, and he's here now, and he is at the worship night, but he is not the God who says, come find me on the mountain. He says, come find me in a manger, a lowly place, a place where everyone's collars weren't pressed, and their lipstick wasn't on just right, and their devotional life did not measure up to what they were about to know about this king, a place where shepherds could come who had nothing to their name, wise men could come who could deny everything that they knew about reality for one moment to see that there was something beyond the stars that they stared at. This was a place for people who did not have the answers. This was a place, and it was hidden right in the middle of the city for those who really wanted to see him, who weren't just looking for another story and greatness, but for someone in some peoples who would stop for a second and say, I think something spectacular is unfolding in the ordinary when I am here. And he's begging us to say on this Sunday to begin Advent in 2025, might God be with you at the car wash, and might God be with you when you get giant raises, and might God be with you when you lose your job, and will you have the humility to turn and see him, glorious as he is, in the ordinary. Gloria Shane Baker and Noel Regney in 1962 wrote the song, Do You Hear What I Hear? Honestly, on the Christmas list of songs, I find it a little weird. Someone's hearing voices and says, I don't want to be around this guy, but the song actually goes really well with the season. They wrote the song in 1962 because the Cold War was happening. There was so much fighting. And they wanted to write a song that were in essence saying, can we get our eyes off of all this fighting for a second and just lift them up? Do you hear it? Everyone's rushing back and forth to be productive. The left and the right are fighting all day today. How do you know that, Daniel? They do every day. Everyone's right and everyone's saving the world, and the other people are trying to stick it to the other side. Sports are saying, aren't you mad? Aren't you excited? The financial sector saying, aren't you worried? Don't you need more? Most religions are saying, have you done enough? And then Advent comes along and says, shh. Do you hear what I hear? The divine is in the ordinary. So I'm done today. And I want to invite you into something during this season. I would love to hear of all of your traditions. I love Christmas traditions. But I don't want you to miss the invitation that you can know God. Personally, presently, sorry if you grew up Baptist, I don't have another P, eternally,
Last week, I introduced the idea of a prayer kind of initiative during the Advent season. I want you to pray, and I want to challenge you to pray 3 times a day during the Advent season. Morning, midday, and evening. Because what if, crazy idea for a second. What if God really came?